Welcome back. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is your call. In 1902, Mother Jones was called the most dangerous woman in America. This is a woman who did not get involved in labor organizing until she was in her 60s. In the new book, Mother Jones, Raising Cain and Consciousness, Simon Cordery writes, Mother Jones became famous for her fiery speeches. Her name was most closely associated with bitter conflicts between owners and workers in Colorado and West Virginia. Though she traveled across the country and participated in strikes everywhere she went, during the course of her career, she was intimidated by private detectives, imprisoned by court-martial, and deported from strike zones for speaking out against low wages and dangerous working conditions. She violated all the norms for women in the early 20th century by swearing, drinking, traveling alone, and resisting authority. On today, Labor Day, we will spend the hour with Simon Cordery to talk about Mother Jones. Simon is professor of modern British history, comparative labor history, and railroad history at Western Illinois University. Thank you so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
So, Simon, a lot of people are familiar with Mother Jones because of the progressive magazine called Mother Jones. But so many people are not familiar with her incredible and tumultuous life. How did you first hear about Mother Jones?
I was very fortunate to attend a history department as an undergraduate with a quite progressive staff. And so the faculty were very interested in labor and social history. And I was introduced to Mother Jones in an American history survey class as a sophomore. It was a wonderful introduction to labor history and a wonderful introduction to a most amazing woman. And Mother Jones has remained in the background of my thinking for quite a while. I've specialized in British social history and British labor history and then moved back into American labor history, and Mother Jones came to the fore again.
I read your entire book and I loved it. It was amazing to me to read the radical statements given by someone like Mother Jones at the age of, 60, 70. In the late 1800s, early 1900s, I could not help but compare what she said to what we are not hearing today. I mean, it's amazing. You have to wonder, how would someone like a Mother Jones be treated in today's time?
In many respects, she would be treated by the leaders of the organizations that she became part of in the same way that she was treated by them in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. Mother Jones hit a glass ceiling. She was a woman in a man's world. Mm-hmm. She was an extraordinarily effective labor organizer and, by all accounts, a compelling and spellbinding orator. But her life was restricted and her life choices were limited by the fact of her gender. I think that had she come back today, she would hear many of the same rhetoric. She would hear many of the same limitations being placed on her. Her ability to mobilize working people, especially working men in the hyper-masculine occupation of coal mining, was a godsend to the union organizers. But because she was a woman, she could not move beyond the ranks of being an organizer. And so had she wanted to become a union officer, that would have proved impossible. And in fact, she left the United Mine Workers of America, the union which she is most closely associated, as a result of unhappiness with exactly those types of issues, with exactly her recognition that she could only go so far.
And you report that she violated all the norms for women in the early 20th century by swearing, drinking, traveling alone, and resisting authority.
Well, Mother Jones had the sort of life that one could imagine would well make a magnificent film. She was almost the Forrest Gump of her era. She was born in Ireland in 1837, just before the Irish potato famine. Her family lived through the Irish potato famine. Her father and her eldest brother left Ireland in 1847, left her with her mother and her other siblings, and the mother and Mary, Mother Jones, and her other sisters and brothers left Ireland and moved to Toronto in the early 1850s. She moved to Memphis, Tennessee, where she got married. She married a union organizer, and they had four children, and she, by her own account, was very happy in this rather staid, conventional role of the stay-at-home wife. And unfortunately, in 1867, a yellow fever epidemic swept through Memphis,
right.
And her husband and their four children died as a result of the epidemic. She moved to Chicago, and she opened a dressmaking business, and she was in Chicago in 1871 when the Great Fire swept through. And as a consequence of the Great Fire, her dressmaking business was destroyed. I mean, she just seemed to have been everywhere bad things happened. Mm-hmm. The only place she appeared not to have been was San Francisco for the earthquake.
Well, and how did her time in Ireland and the struggles that she dealt with, or I should say saw as a child, how did that really shape her views later in life?
What she saw in Ireland were scenes of devastation and horror, scenes in which children her age were dying. One of the symptoms of starvation and the various ailments that people suffered from, dysentery and all sorts of terrible, terrible sicknesses, was hair falling out. Mm-hmm. And so lots of her friends died after their hair fell out. It was just visually a terrible, awful thing. The landscape was quiet. Can you imagine a landscape without birds? But what happened in great swathes of Ireland in the 1840s was that most natural life died. Most of it was killed. They were killed by people desperate for food, because the potato famine fed well over a quarter of the people of Ireland. And when the potatoes were destroyed by this fungus, people starved. Mother Jones recognized early on that there was a tremendous gulf in society between the haves and the have-nots, and she was clearly marked as a have-not. There were oats and other cereals and grains being grown in Ireland that were grown by farmers working for English-owned farms, and the harvests, even at the depths of the potato famine, the harvests went to England to feed English workers. So there was food there that Mother Jones and other Irish people were aware of, but it was being shipped to England because of the ownership of the land. And Mother Jones recognized that society is divided, and that the vast majority of people are left behind. And her life's work, certainly her work in the last third of her life, was devoted to trying to close that gap and to rectify that severe inequality. So her life in Ireland during the potato famine was extraordinarily formative, as was her Catholic faith. She was brought up in the Catholic Church. That's another way in which she understood that there were those in power, the Protestants in Ireland, and those who were out of power, the large majority of people who were practicing or trying to practice their Roman Catholic faith in Ireland. And though she turned her back on the church as an institution, she never lost sight of religion as a source of rhetoric, as a way to understand the world. It infused her speeches. So Ireland, yes, you're absolutely right, Rose. Ireland was extremely important in the making of Mother Jones.
Well, and also it was amazing to read what she said about the church. And again, I was thinking, could you imagine if a woman like this spoke out today? For example, you write, "For prayer, she had little time, telling one audience, quote, 'I long ago quit praying and took to swearing. If I pray, I will have to wait until I am dead to get anything. But when I swear, I get things here.'" She railed against the hypocrisy of church leaders living in wealth gained by, quote, "robbing the representatives of Jesus." And she called bishops, quote, "sky pilots" for what she considered their obsession with theology and their apathy toward human suffering, especially child labor. I mean, I cannot imagine anyone speaking like this today.
Certainly there are women within the Catholic Church who speak out against the Catholic hierarchy, but they tend to be essentially suppressed. Their voices are certainly not heard. And yes, it's impossible to think that anyone who spoke like that would gain the sort of prominence that Mother Jones gained.
Right, exactly. And the women that do speak out, they walk a very delicate line. I mean, their tone is fairly low. They choose their words very carefully. Whereas in reading this book, you can almost see her. What was her speech like? What did it sound like?
We have plenty of written accounts of her speeches. The written accounts are in newspapers. They are, many of them, reported by government intelligence agents, army intelligence agents who were in strike zones to help keep a lid on things. And in every case, her speeches, her public speeches, are full of very, very strong images, very, very powerful language, and also a kind of an earthy brogue. Reporters who met Mother Jones reported that they were stunned when they met her that her actual person-to-person speech was quite cultivated, whereas she had this fiery, brogue-filled rhetoric that she used from the stump. So, yeah, her speeches appear to have been very well crafted, extremely well delivered, and very good at mobilizing people.
And it was sort of funny to read that she didn't always tell the truth.
She neither told nor wrote the truth quite a lot. Yes, there's an awful lot of Mother Jones. I suppose you could generously call it blarney in her letters and in her speeches, and especially in her autobiography, which was published towards the end of her life. Her autobiography makes all sorts of marvelous claims about where she was early on and how she became who she was by participating in Pittsburgh in the great railroad strike of 1877, by being in all of these sort of turning points in American labor history, most of which she couldn't possibly have actually attended. But the point is for Mother Jones to connect with her audiences and to give them a sense of why who they are is important and what they do is important. And that is part of her charm, part of her magic, if you like, was to make these working people who have come, many of them, as first-generation immigrants to the United States of America in the 1880s, 1890s, 1900s, and make them realize that they have strength collectively, and that what they need to do is to refuse to adopt the prevailing ideology of individualism, this kind of laissez-faire individualism that the United States of America champions, the idea that the individual is the only legitimate way to understand society, that collective action is somehow unnecessary, that collective action is somehow un-American. Mother Jones argued consistently that your power is in your mass, in your numbers, and that is what you should use.
And what a message we need today, the same exact message. I mean, so much of what she said in her speeches to workers, basically, I mean, she railed on these men and sometimes the women, and we can talk about that later in the show, but she railed on them and said, you know, stand up, use your voice, collectively, you are so powerful.
That's right. Yes, she was very interested in reminding people that they shouldn't be helpless victims. Mm-hmm. They shouldn't see themselves as unable to, despite all of the barriers they faced, all the constraints on their lives, they shouldn't allow themselves to be ground down by the circumstances of their lives.
We're speaking with Simon Cordery, professor and chair of the history department at Western Illinois University, about his new book, Mother Jones, Raising Cain and Consciousness. And this is a pre-taped special Labor Day show, so unfortunately, we cannot take any of your phone calls. What's amazing also about Mary Harris, Mother Jones, is that her activism in support of American workers began after the age of 60. What really drove her to get involved at that age?
Let me tell you what she said, and then let me tell you what I think.
Okay.
First of all, what she said. Mother Jones said that she was radicalized by experiences like the Great Strike of 1877, like witnessing the police shooting of strikers during the Pullman conflict of 1894. She was radicalized by traveling through the United States, especially when she went to visit the Ruskin community, a utopian community in Tennessee in the 1890s, when she went to participate in Kansas City in Cox's army, which was a march of unemployed workers to the nation's capital, protesting against the lack of federal action to to end unemployment at the height of what I think today we would fairly call at very least a great recession, if not a depression. And she also began selling a newspaper called The Appeal to Reason, which was a socialist newspaper. And she read the newspaper, she believed it, she understood that it had a very powerful message to offer the working people of America. And so Mother Jones crafts this image of herself as being someone who had very, very strong experiences within the labor movement. And it's telling that she calls herself Mother Jones, and we should return to that point in a moment. But historians, I said, what do I think? Well, what I think, of course, and what other historians think, is that the moments at which she was radicalized are probably more than likely the fact that she seems to have worked in factories in the South. She seems to have, a part of her wandering around the United States after the death of her husband and their four children in 1867 led her to work in rope factories and cotton mills in Alabama and Tennessee, and her experiences in those factories, especially witnessing child labor, made her realize that the Republic, the United States of America, in which an educated electorate is absolutely crucial, was being betrayed by factory owners who hired children, gave them no time to go and learn to read and write and make informed choices about the state and nature of the political system. So she was clearly an intelligent woman. She was clearly someone who probably in the late 1890s recognized that her physical image, the white hair, the dresses, in that day, the old dresses, she herself was a dressmaker, so she was able to make dresses that conveyed a respectable, kind of a grandma-ish image. And that certainly helped to give her entry into labor unions. But she also, remember, experienced labor unions in Memphis because her husband, George Jones, had been a skilled worker. George Jones had been an iron molder, and he was a member of one of the strongest unions in the United States at the time. And so Mother Jones clearly benefited from unionism. And it seems that as she was carving a persona for herself, as she was creating a role for herself, she returned to that time in her life and tried to bring the elements of unionism to all working people, especially to working men. She was very much interested in organizing working men.
You write also that over the course of her career, she was threatened at gunpoint, kidnapped and deported, imprisoned for making or threatening to make speeches, and tried by court-martial. So she paid a very high price. I mean, even though she had this grandmotherly look, the unions and the government had no problems going after her.
Unfortunately, you're right. And it was mostly the government that systematically tried to deny her First Amendment right to speak out.
I should say, I'm sorry, not the unions, the mine bosses.
Oh, the owners.
The owners, yes.
Absolutely,
right,
yeah,
right.
The mine operators,
right.
Yes. Her most prominent activism was in Colorado and West Virginia. West Virginia she called medieval West Virginia because the mine operators had such power. They had power over the daily lives of their employees, and they had political power exercised through the West Virginia legislature and also the governor of West Virginia. The mine operators owned most of the land around the mines. For example, when she wanted to walk into mine areas, she had to walk along the only public highway, which in many cases was a stream or a riverbed, because the roads themselves were privately owned. And had she walked along the roads, she would have been arrested. In West Virginia, there's many examples, many times when Mother Jones tries to help people, but because they help her, they get arrested. The mine companies own the housing and they own the stores. And so on a couple of occasions, we learn about mining families who gave Mother Jones a roof over her head for a night or two being evicted by the operators because they had helped this notorious organizer. Mother Jones was distinctive, and that distinctiveness was both her strength and also perhaps a source of weakness. And the weakness was because she's very quickly recognized as a very dangerous woman.
Mm.
And so wherever she goes, she knows she's courting arrest. She's court-martialed twice. She was court-martialed in West Virginia in 1902. She was court-martialed again in Colorado in 1914, in both cases because of her activism during strikes, against coal miners. Strikes against coal mines.
I'm sure so many people are learning a lot of new information about Mother Jones, and I want to read just a really amazing quote by Father McGuire, who was speaking, I should say Reverend J.W.R. McGuire, who was speaking at her funeral in 1930. She died at the age of 93 in Chicago, and he told the crowd, quote, "Wealthy coal operators and capitalists throughout the U.S. are breathing sighs of relief, while toil-worn men and women are weeping tears of bitter grief. The reason for this contrast of relief and sorrow is apparent. Mother Jones is dead. For many Americans," he said, "she represented all that was finest in womanhood, armed with only the weapons of a burning mother's love, a flaming tongue and spirit. She went forth to convince a cold, money-glutted world of the need for justice, mercy, and love." And, I mean, these are just amazing words to hear about a woman who got started in activism in her 60s.
Yes. She clearly touched the soul of America in a way that was unexpected. Her death was accompanied by an outpouring of really celebrations of her life, and that's the way she would have wanted it. Mother Jones was... Well, you correctly stated that she died when she was 93 years old. Of course, she was living for the last few years of her life in Silver Spring, Maryland, just outside Washington, D.C., and she told everyone that when the 1st of May 1930 came, she would like to travel to Chicago in order to celebrate her 100th birthday, because she had consistently said that she was born on the 1st of May 1830. Historical evidence suggests otherwise, but Mother Jones wasn't one to let historical evidence get in the way of a good story. So, of course, being born on May Day in 1930 allowed her to celebrate her centenary while she was still alive. And that in and of itself was quite an event. Her house in Silver Spring, Maryland was the site of, one might say, a number of almost pilgrimages by labor leaders, by political leaders, by ordinary people who came to celebrate with her. She gave a very brief radio address on that day, a radio address that was her last public speech. She was photographed. She exchanged telegrams with all sorts of people, including John D. Rockefeller, with whom she had had a very, very acrimonious relationship since the Ludlow Massacre of 1914. And she was, at that moment, clearly a very, very prominent celebrity in American life. In fact, in around 1925, the Chicago Tribune started, in its looking back 10 years, started to include snippets of her life from 25 years ago, from 15 years ago, from 10 years ago. Mother Jones would occasionally appear in those Chicago Tribune retrospectives.
We're speaking with Simon Cordery, professor and chair of the history department at Western Illinois University. He is author of the new book, Mother Jones, Raising Cain and Consciousness. And this is a pre-taped special Labor Day show, so unfortunately we cannot take any of your phone calls. You're listening to Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
KALW is media sponsor for Chinese Whispers, Bay Chronicles, a project that sets out to recover the lost history of Chinese shrimp fishing around San Francisco Bay. This September, a team of artists, archaeologists, and scientists will set sail on a replica 19th century Chinese junk to former shrimping sites around the bay. You can connect with this hidden history at three public events during the sailing expedition. The first one is coming up this Saturday, September 6th, at the Richmond Craneway. Learn more at Chinese-whispers.org.
Welcome back. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. And today we're speaking with Simon Cordery, professor and chair of the History Department at Western Illinois University, about his new book, Mother Jones, Raising Cain and Consciousness. This is a pre-taped special Labor Day show, so unfortunately we cannot take any of your phone calls. What about her relationship with politics? As we are in the middle of the presidential race, and you know, there's so much talk about union supporting President Obama, giving him money. Why? What has he done for them? The Employee Free Choice Act. I mean, you know, the list goes on. It was interesting to hear Mother Jones talk about the Democratic and Republican parties. And you write that she spent 6 years working as a speaker for the Socialist Party, telling voters not to throw away their ballot on the Democrats and the Republicans, but to join the Socialists because they actually cared about the workers, whereas she said the Democrats and Republicans were nothing more than capitalist parties.
That's right. But what's interesting about that, of course, is that she still has at least a modicum of faith in the American political system. I mean, she was a believer in republicanism, in the ideology of republicanism. And you're right, she did not want working people to vote for the two major parties, even though she herself claimed to have met at least six presidents. And we can indeed document that she met at the very least two presidents and probably more. So her relationship with the American political system is a somewhat ambiguous one. She hammers away at it. She hammers away at politicians for ignoring working people. And she uses much of the same rhetoric that she used to hammer away at labor leaders for losing sight of the mission of the labor unions, which is to help people. She had a great deal of faith in democracy, but also a fear that because working people were being blinded by the messages of the Democrats and the Republicans, their power was being eviscerated, their collective power that she wanted working people to use. She's a great believer in class consciousness. She's a great believer in the power of the working class, but she sees that power being dissipated with these useless parties, the Democrats and the Republicans. And for her, that is a very real and tragic loss, because it means that working people can't get the types of lives and especially the living standards that they deserve. At one level, although she's extremely ideological, she's very much a bread-and-butter unionist. She believes that what unions should do is help working people get better working conditions, a shorter working day, higher wages, and indeed what was called at the time the family wage. She's very much a believer in the patriarchy. Even though she's Mother Jones out on the front lines, she believes that the unions should fight for the family wage so that the wives of working people can stay at home and raise those good young Republican children in the way that they should do.
Well, and that was interesting because you also write that she was an inconsistent supporter of women's suffrage. And as you said, she often did encourage women to sort of be good wives at home while the men were out at least trying to make a living.
That's right, yes.
How did the women respond to that? Because at the same time, at times she also kind of railed on the women, saying, you know, get out and support your husbands and use your voices.
Absolutely. One of the ways in which she became known as a union organizer was for the mop and broom brigades in the anthracite strike of 1900 in Pennsylvania, western Pennsylvania. Mother Jones organizes the wives of coal miners to come out and help their men. And you're right, she is unafraid to criticize them for staying home and expecting things to get better without their assistance. But she mobilizes women. So she sees contradictorily, and I think contradiction is one of the essences of Mother Jones, she sees a public role for women in supporting the strikes that she hopes will result in their being able to stay at home. Is there a contradiction there? Mother Jones wouldn't have said so, but maybe there is a little bit.
What was her relationship like with women? Did she have many women around her, or was she mostly with men?
That's a great question. She was almost exclusively surrounded by men.
Huh.
People like Terence Powderly and John Mitchell, the organizer, John Mitchell, the president of the United Mine Workers, and Terence Powderly, who was the leader of the Knights of Labor and also a good personal friend of Mother Jones. She made personal friends with men, and I think there's a sense that she was a little bit suspicious of other women. Remember, she styled herself Mother Jones. Now, how many mothers can a labor movement have?
Right.
So she's always looking over her shoulder, a little bit worried about the power of other women. Mm. She also wanted to be a martyr. She had a martyr complex, and she's, at the end of her life, a little bit disappointed that she wasn't killed in the line of duty, because that would have solidified her place, and also, she thought, would have been a rallying point for working people to rise up, and if not overthrow the state, certainly rise up and use their collective power to change the state.
What else can you tell us about women at that time? Because just a couple of weeks ago, we marked Women's Equality Day.
Women were certainly not equal in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, and many women worked. The ideology, of course, was still the ideology of separate spheres, where the ideal was that the husband goes out to work and the wife stays at home. Well, that was an ideal that may have been true for middle-class families, but it certainly wasn't true for the families that Mother Jones helped to organize. And so women workers had to take in washing if they had children to raise. They worked as seamstresses. Women who went out to work quite often still worked in factories. Young women worked in factories. Young women also found themselves in, for example, bottle washing plants. There's a great story of Mother Jones organizing the bottle washers of Milwaukee, Wisconsin, in which she helps them organize because, as she said, although you ought to be at home, you don't have the wherewithal to be at home, so you might as well do the best you can for your families.
And what percentage of workers back then were union members, and what did they get as a result?
Union membership was quite small in most occupations. For mine workers in what was called the Central Consolidated Field, which included parts of Pennsylvania, West Virginia, Ohio, Indiana, and Illinois, joined the United Mine Workers of America after it was recognized as the union by the bosses in 1902. Now, did that mean 100% joined? No, not at all. It meant that mine workers joined at rates of probably no more than 50%, but no more than 50% is still a very high percentage. And there are other select industries, mostly what we would consider skilled industry, where access to the occupation was restricted, where membership could be as high as 60 or 70%, locomotive engineers, for example, on the railroads. But most people, most workers, men and women, were not organized. And what Mother Jones hoped the unions could do would be to provide a kind of a vanguard that would raise living standards for everybody. What did workers get out of the unions? Well, if you were a member of the United Mine Workers of America, you had a voice in negotiation through your union leadership with the bosses. You had the ability to protest. You had a formal grievance system that enabled you to make the mine operators aware that there are safety issues that they have to confront, that there are working day concerns, the length of the working day in particular, that they had to confront. So it gave working people a voice in the workplace, and also provided, in many cases, basic insurance. Most unions had what we would today call insurance benefits, sickness benefits, accident benefits, and the all-important funeral benefit.
We're speaking with Simon Cordery, professor and chair of the History Department at Western Illinois University, about his new book, Mother Jones, Raising Cain and Consciousness. And this is a pre-taped special Labor Day show, so unfortunately we cannot take any of your phone calls. And we're talking about Mary Harris, Mother Jones' incredible life as an activist in her 60s, 70s, and 80s, a force to be reckoned with in the labor movement. And I just wonder what it would be like today if we had someone like this, or at least people like this, who spoke so honestly about the system that we have today. And, you know, I wondered, when I was reading your book, Simon, I thought, what is Simon, when he did his research, what was going through your mind when you think about the effect that Mother Jones had on the labor movement back then? And when we look at what's going on today, in 2011, the Bureau of Labor Statistics reported that the number of Americans working in unions declined sharply in 2010 to about 12%, the lowest rate in more than 70 years. And we just recently did a show about Walmart, and we had a woman on who's organizing warehouse workers in Los Angeles. Now, so many of these organizers are afraid to even use the word union, and so they don't put it on their websites. And she told us that some of the warehouse workers in Los Angeles do not have access to clean water. They're drinking brown water, and they're dealing with unbearable heat. They're barely making $8 an hour. And so I just wonder, when you did your research about Mother Jones and read her fiery speeches, and then you look at what we're dealing with today, I mean, how are you making sense of this?
In terms of how I responded to Mother Jones as I was doing the research, my sort of naive sense of Mother Jones was that she was this almost out of control, fiery radical. But the woman I encountered as I read her speeches and her letters, as I read newspaper accounts of her travels and especially the accounts of people who met her, it's clear that underpinning all of her radicalism is a very, very firm belief in the labor theory of value, and that is that those who create wealth should get their fair share of wealth. So Mother Jones would be horrified by the fact that only 12% of American workers are members of unions. She would find that to be completely unacceptable. She would also, I suspect, I hate to put thoughts and words into the mouth and mind of a historical figure, but I suspect that she would say to the warehouse organizers who are organizing in LA and elsewhere, she would say, you are doing incredibly brave and vital work. Mm-hmm. And yes, there's danger involved. And yes, you're going to find yourself encountering the power of the state. And she understood all too well what the power of the state combined with the power of the bosses, because she didn't see too much difference between them. The power of the state and the power of the bosses means that every step you take is a step that could be your last. And she knew union organizers who had been murdered, union organizers whose deaths were unresolved crimes because they were murdered by mine guards or by the hired thugs of the bosses. So Mother Jones's words today would resonate, and they would resonate in part because of that backbone of the idea that those who create wealth should get their fair share of it, and people who work in factories, people who work in stores, people essentially the frontline workers in retail, and also those we don't see behind the scenes in factories are not getting their fair share of the wealth of America.
Right, or farm workers, for example, because here in California, our politicians are about to take up a bill, AB 2346, that would require farm workers to have shade only if the temperatures reach above 85. So I don't know if it's 83. I guess they'll give them hats or something. I mean, it's so bizarre. And it would require them to provide clean drinking water. I mean, this is the year 2012, and this bill is called controversial.
Yeah, it's stunning, isn't it?
It is.
And at the same time as Mother Jones is calling for mine safety measures, Mother Jones and the United Mine Workers of America are calling for mine safety measures to be put into effect. Well, the operators are saying, oh, that'll drive up the cost of mining and drive us out of business. And I think that's been a constant refrain. I think, remember back to the debates over the seatbelts, making seatbelts mandatory in the 1960s and 70s, the car manufacturers were saying, if we are required to put seatbelts into our cars, we'll go bankrupt.
Right. And they tried to slam Ralph Nader for the work that he was doing on that issue.
That's right.
I mean, they went after him in so many ways. They tried to set him up going after women in bars. I mean, it's unbelievable.
Yeah.
What do you think people can learn from Mother Jones? Even setting wages aside, we're talking about people not having access to clean drinking water in the year 2012 in the United States.
Yeah, Mother Jones would say that's completely unacceptable, because, of course, the dignity of labor must be recognized. Whether you're working in a field, whether you're working in a factory, whether you're working in an office, if labor isn't understood to be valuable in and of itself and therefore should be remunerated, then you've lost sight of what's important in life. And I think she would say, she would suggest, or her writings certainly suggest, that collective action is the only form of protest for those without power.
What do you think she would say to the unions who have aligned themselves so closely with the Democratic Party and basically at this point feel that that's their only option?
She would say, you've sold out. She was very angry with John Mitchell because John Mitchell, the leader of the United Mine Workers of America, forged an agreement with President Theodore Roosevelt to end the 1902 anthracite strike. And the agreement was basically to allow the strike to end, and then a commission was formed that met some of the workers' demands for better wages and better working conditions. Mother Jones felt firmly that John Mitchell had sold out. And she saw John Mitchell joining, for example, the National Civic Federation, which was an organization that tried to bring together the bosses and the union bosses. And she saw people like Mark Hanna, the politician who was kind of the puppet master behind William McKinley, joining the National Civic Federation. And she, Mother Jones, would say, once you sit down over a glass of whiskey and a cigar with those against whom you should be battling, you have lost the battle. And she would say, I suspect, to union bosses today, to the AFL, if you sit down with the leaders of the Democratic Party, you may indeed make some short-term gains, but long-term, things are not going to improve, and you've sold out. She had that tremendous vision of someone who saw beyond the immediate moment, and she understood that what John Mitchell did in 1902 was to become beguiled by Theodore Roosevelt and to lose sight of the fact that the struggle was on his side. The mine workers were winning. That was her perception, and she did not like that kind of cooperation.
We're speaking with Simon Cordery, professor and chair of the History Department at Western Illinois University, about his book, Mother Jones, Raising Cain and Consciousness, an incredible labor activist who did not get involved in activism until she was in her 60s, which is incredible. She told a New York Times journalist when she was 80, I haven't longed to live anyhow. Since I have to die, I would rather die for the cause to which I have given so much of my life. My death would call the attention of the whole United States to conditions in West Virginia. It would be worthwhile for that reason. A Philadelphia Daily reported her as being, quote, ready for the eternal sleep, saying, I will die gladly, and challenging the authorities to string me up to your tree. That is the only way that you can still my voice. Amazing words again, Simon, from Mother Jones. I just love reading her quotes.
Yeah, she's a very powerful speaker and also someone who did some pretty amazing things. One element of her life that we haven't even touched on is the Children's Crusade.
Yes, I'm glad. I wanted to bring that up. I'm glad you brought that up.
Yeah, I mean, 1903, Mother Jones was invited to visit strikes all across the United States, and she didn't own a home. She traveled incessantly. And in June of 1903, she went to Kensington, Pennsylvania, near Philadelphia, where there was a textile strike. And she looked around and she said, why aren't the newspapers reporting this strike? And the journalists apparently told her, well, it's because the textile owners are in charge of, they own the newspapers. And she said, we need to call attention to this strike. And she came up with this brilliant idea of having what would become known as the Children's Crusade, where she gathered the children of the striking families, of the striking textile families, but many of whom were themselves textile workers. And so she marched from Philadelphia to New York City, getting tremendous publicity along the way, not only for the strike in Philadelphia, but also for the issue of child labor. And child labor was abhorrent to Mother Jones, as it was indeed to many reformers in the early 20th century. The outcome of the Children's Crusade was not quite as successful as she wanted it to be. Originally she was going to go to New York City to a large socialist rally to help raise money for the socialists of New York and also to shine a light on child labor. Halfway through the march, she decided that it would be good to go to Sagamore Bay, to go to see President Theodore Roosevelt at his summer home and bring children with him to show him the contrast between his own well-fed, well-educated, well-off children and the children who worked in the factories. Unfortunately, President Theodore Roosevelt decided that he wasn't going to meet with her, I suppose in part because he didn't want any old Tom, Dick or Harry dropping in to see him. But it was, in terms of its publicity value, tremendously powerful. And in terms of bringing to the public consciousness the issue of child labor, again, very, very powerful.
Can you tell us a little bit about the strike in Philadelphia, the largest strike in Philadelphia's history?
Yeah, it was textile workers were going out on strike in large measure because the textile owners, there was no one single company, but the owners got together and decided they were going to lower the wages of the workers. And that's something that we tend to forget in American history, that many 19th century unions were founded not to fight for higher wages, but to protest against wage decreases.
Mm.
And so Mother Jones arrives in Kensington, and she stirs things up. She's brilliant at that. She does that all over the place. But that's part of her modus operandi, is to motivate people to see the bigger picture, to see beyond their immediate strikes, to see beyond their immediate needs, and to connect those needs to the larger concerns of working Americans. And she does that brilliantly. She does it in Kensington, Pennsylvania. She does it all across the United States.
And you report that in 1903 in Pennsylvania, by the time she traveled to the area in Philadelphia, 600 or more mills had closed, 100,000 workers, including 16,000 children, were out of work.
Yes. Yeah. And of course, there's no unemployment insurance. Mm. So basically, by being locked out by the mill owners, the working people of Philadelphia, of Kensington, Pennsylvania, are forced back on their own resources.
And Simon, before we end, what other parts of American history have we forgotten?
Well, Mother Jones was present at the founding of the IWW, the organization whose members became known as the Wobblies. She was in Chicago in January 1905, and again in Chicago in June 1905 for the first was a secret meeting, the second was a public meeting, forming this union of all unions, the International Workers of the World, the IWW. And she was also very, very involved in what we would today call human rights issues. She spent a lot of time campaigning for people who were being persecuted by the federal government, including Mexican revolutionaries who had escaped from Mexico, trying to escape from the clutches of Diaz, the president of Mexico before the revolution of 1912. And she was, Mother Jones was willing to spend a lot of time raising funds for their defense. The same for Big Bill Haywood, the leader of the Western Federation of Mines, which had a reputation as being an incredibly radical organization. And Big Bill Haywood and two other union leaders were imprisoned on trumped-up charges of murdering the governor of Idaho, in part as a way to marginalize the union at a time of great stress. So, I mean, she has this human rights element to her as well. Mother Jones, I suspect, would say, okay, so we have an African-American president, so what? Part of her rhetoric is about that kind of radical equality that says what's different is not the color of people's skin, mm-hmm. but the quality of their minds. And she had no time for people who said, well, you know, African Americans shouldn't be in unions or African Americans shouldn't vote. She didn't see that as an issue. She said, as long as a person is willing to stand up and make a claim and work hard, who cares?
And as you report, she spoke to everyone regardless of race or ethnicity, even as many unions banned non-whites from joining.
Absolutely. Virtually every union banned non-whites from joining the union ranks, yes, in part to placate their white, and let's be honest, white supremacist membership.
Hmm. And final thoughts, Simon, we've got about a minute left. Anything else you'd like to share about what you discovered about Mother Jones?
Well, it's one of those events in American history that kind of has slipped below the radar, mm-hmm. and that is what happened in Ludlow, Colorado on Sunday, the 19th of April, 1914, when, as a long-running coal strike was grinding on, there was a conflict, a gunfight between miners and the mining guards, the company guards, and the miners ran out of bullets, and they went into the hills to try and lure the guards away from this encampment, literally tents, where the mining families were, and the mining company guards shot into and set fire to the camp, and they killed women and children in one of the most brutal massacres in American history. And Ludlow has sort of vanished from the radar screens, as has the Battle of Blair Mountain in 1921, in August 1921, the largest pitched battle on American soil since the Civil War. And there's a very powerful group trying to save Blair Mountain from mining, to make it into a preserved historic site. But those have vanished from the textbooks, and that's a huge loss.
Well, thank you for bringing them back. and we'd love to have you back to do a show about the history of labor. Simon Cordery is professor and chair of the history department at Western Illinois University and author of Mother Jones, Raising Cain and Consciousness. Simon, thank you so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure. Thank you very much, Rose.
Thank you. And thank you for listening. Happy Labor Day. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. And here's what's coming up tomorrow. What bills are headed to the governor's desk? On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation about the bills that have recently passed or are pending in the California State Legislature. These bills would affect everything from health care and paid sick leave to sexual harassment and plastic bags. Governor Jerry Brown has until the end of September to either sign or veto legislation. He recently signed legislation to put a $7.5 billion water bond before voters. So what bills are you following? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar. And you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter, or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Debbie Kennedy is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.